Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam namaskritya. Naram chaiva narottamam. Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam. Tato jayam udirayet. Nasta prayeshwa badreshu. Nityam bhagavata sevaya. Bhagavati uttama shloke. Bhaktir bhavati naishtaki. This morning we'll read from chapter 7, verses 23 through 26. So again, it's a little bit convoluted. We had to skip those yesterday. Go ahead. Thank you again, Krishna Kripa Prabhu. And I just want to say how much I enjoy giving classes, being here for classes at Krishna House. I think it's very important to get the nice cross-pollination of devotees that we have giving classes, including students who have to give classes for the welfare, for the pleasure of all. We all get to watch them suffer and squirm. But the devotees who I invite here for class are people I feel have realized a lot of the topics we'll be discussing this morning about how to approach Krishna. So I'm specifically grateful to them, and in general grateful to you for taking part in this, because believe it or not, in life it is rare to have an opportunity to attend Bhagavatam classes daily with nice devotees. Is that not correct? Those of you who've been around for a while, Krishna Kripa Prabhu is the only exception, because he is a Madhukari bumblebee floating from place to place wherever there are Bhagavatam classes to be attended. So before we read these verses, I'd like to do a little background to bring you up, make sure that all the gaps are filled in as far as the personalities in these pastimes and the purpose and the context of them. So to start, I'm going to do a one-minute synopsis of the first six chapters of the first canto. This has never been attempted before. Okay. Sages at Naimisharan. Sutta, you are so wise. Tell us about Krishna. Tell us about the highest good for humanity. And tell us what's going to happen to the world now that Krishna has left. My dear sages, the highest good for all human beings is devotional service to Lord Krishna. And Krishna comes in countless incarnations. And in Kali Yuga, he's incarnated as the Srimad Bhagavatam, his literary incarnation. And that will guide people in Kali Yuga. That's incredible. How did the Srimad Bhagavatam come to be spoken? Vyasadeva had written all of the Vedas and the Mahabharata, and he was dissatisfied, so his guru Narada came, and he gave his own life as an example of how hearing about Krishna can transform somebody. So therefore, he wrote the Bhagavatam so that everyone could be benefited. That's fantastic. And how was it that Sukadeva came to speak Srimad Bhagavatam when he was already enlightened? Why did he want to hear Srimad Bhagavatam? Even self-satisfied persons are very pleased to hear about the pastimes of Krishna. Well, how did Maharaj Parikshit come to hear the Srimad Bhagavatam? Okay, listen and I'll tell you the story. So that's where we are up to this chapter. Okay. So all of this has brought us to the point now where we learn about Maharaj Parikshit and how he came to hear the Bhagavatam. In fact, the remaining 12 chapters of the first canto are dedicated to this topic. Okay. So we've gone through a lot in the first six chapters. Now for the remaining, actually 13 chapters, we'll have the story of Maharaj Parikshit, which is just beginning in this section. Okay. Now, before we read, I want to just do a little more background. Those who know this, please bear with us. Those who don't, please listen carefully, because there's a lot of names being bandied about that you may not know or understand in context to these pastimes. So this portion of the Mahabharata begins with the story of Drona. Drona and Drupad. Drona was a Brahmin and Drupad was a prince. But as is the custom, they were put together in the Gurukula and they became fast friends. And Drupad said to Drona, "When I grow up, I'm going to give you half of my kingdom." And Drona said, "No, no, I don't. I want you to have half the kingdom." So this is sort of a tradition that the kings would give their kingdom to the Brahmins, and the Brahmins would say, "Okay, I accept it. Now I give it back to you to manage in a God-conscious way." But what happened was Drupad and Drona, when they grew, they separated. And Drona was, I guess he was affected by the recession. You know, he was having a hard time making a living. His division had been cut off or something. Now, he had one son named Ashwatthama, who was his only dependent, aside from his wife, Kripi, but he could not provide milk for Ashwatthama. And in fact, they were so poor that Ashwatthama's friends made up this white chalky liquid and gave it to him to drink. And he said, "What is that?" He said, "Oh, this is milk." He had never had milk, so he drank it, and it was terrible, and everyone was laughing at him. So his father was really embarrassed and really determined to. So his wife said, "Why don't you go ask Drupad, not for half the kingdom, but for some charity?" And so he went, and Drupad, for one reason or another, rebuffed him. He didn't give him anything. And so Drona became deeply offended by this. So he decided that although he was a Brahmin, he would learn the arts of the Kshatriya. And because he was a Brahmin, he was able to learn, was it from Parasuram? Right? His martial guru. So Parasuram would not teach Kshatriyas, but he would teach Brahmins. So he taught Drona. And Drona became known as a very powerful Kshatriya. But as a Brahmin, his role was a teacher. So his position was teaching martial arts. So one day, at this point, all of the Pandava sons and the sons of Dhritarashtra were all together in school, young boys. And one day they were playing with a ball and it went into a well. So they all gathered around the well. "How are we going to get it out?" And suddenly this stranger appeared and said, "You're sons of kings and you can't figure out how to do this?" So he took a piece of grass and recited a mantra and threw it. And it became hard as a nail, and speared the ball. And they took another piece of grass again, and then he speared the backside of the first piece of grass. And this way he made a chain all the way up to the top of the well and pulled out the ball. So the boys were all amazed and they said, "Who are you?" And he said, "Go tell Bhishma what I have done, and then he will tell you who I am." So they ran to Bhishma, and he said, "Oh, Drona has come." He had been waiting for a martial guru for these boys. So he immediately hired Drona. Finally, Drona got off unemployment, and he became the martial guru for all of the boys, and very, very close to them all. But he also shared his knowledge with his own son, Ashwatthama. So he wanted he wanted his own son to be the greatest warrior, but Arjuna was always a better archer. And in this way, there was always some rivalry there between Ashwatthama and Arjuna. So now we fast forward through all the intrigue and politics of the Mahabharata to the Battle of Kurukshetra. And there, Drona was on the side of Duryodhana because they were his employers and he was loyal to them. And Arjuna and Krishna were on the side of course, the Pandavas. Now, Drupad was also on the side of the Pandavas. What happened after Drona had trained all the boys, they owed him Guru Dakshin. So he said, "Okay, I want you to defeat Drupad, who wouldn't give me a job." So the sons of Dhritarashtra attacked him and were all defeated and captured. So then the sons of Pandu attacked, and they captured Drupad and brought him back, bound up, before Dronacharya. And Drona said, although you would not give me the charity I asked for, I will give you charity. Now that I have taken your kingdom, I will give half of it back to you. So Drupad had no choice but to accept that and stalk off. And of course he was furious. So he performed his austerities and a sacrifice so that he could have a child that would kill Dronacharya. So from this sacrifice, it was a fire. Out came a brilliant baby that he named Drishtadyumna. And then also came a female child who he named Draupadi. So later the Pandavas married Draupadi, and her father fought on their side in the battle. Drishtadyumna was also on their side as the commander in chief? Yeah, commander of the armies. So he was trained by Drona. Even though he was born to kill Drona, Drona trained him in the military arts. Pardon me? Yes, Drona knew that. Yes, they're very noble. So in the battle, Drona was fighting very hard, although his heart was not into it. And Duryodhana had a way of just pushing his buttons and telling him, "You're not trying hard. You like them better than me. You've always liked them better than me." You know, and so he'd get furious and say, "All right, today I will." Did he make that vow? "I will kill." I don't know. I forgot. That was Bhishma, yeah. Anyway, Drona was fighting so ferociously. He started using weapons which were inappropriate for the circumstances. These mantra-driven weapons that would wipe out massive numbers of troops. So Krishna said that to Yudhishthira, "You had better do something about this or your entire army is going to be wiped out." And he said, "What can I do?" And he said, "Say that Ashwatthama is slain." And then Drona will no longer want to fight. And Yudhishthira said, "I can't say that. That would be a lie. I've never told a lie in my entire life." So it's said that because Yudhishthira refused Krishna's instruction on the basis of morality, later he had to go to hell for a short visit. But at that point, Krishna turned to Bhima, who had a slightly lower moral standard. And Bhima found an elephant named Ashwatthama, and he brought that elephant and killed it. And he said, "Now, Yudhishthira, say it." And Yudhishthira, ever righteous, said, "Ashwatthama, the elephant is slain." But knowing he was going to do that, somebody, was it Krishna? Krishna. He blew his conch shell when he said, "The elephant." So, all Drona heard is, "Ashwatthama is slain." And he said, "Yudhishthira, is it true?" And Yudhishthira said, "Yes." So at that point, Drona lost his will to fight completely. And he just sat down to commit suicide through mystic meditation. And in that posture, where he had dropped all of his weapons and he was meditating, Drishtadyumna came up with his sword and decapitated him. So that was an enormous insult to his son, Ashwatthama. So the war went on. Finally, all of Duryodhana's soldiers had been killed, and the Pandavas had a small number of survivors. So they had won. Duryodhana was mortally injured. He was dying, but not yet dead. They just left him to die on the battlefield. And Ashwatthama, Kripacharya, and one other, Kritavarma, were the only three survivors on the side of Duryodhana. So they went to Duryodhana as he was lying there in mortal pain and said, We want to get our revenge, avenge your death on the Pandavas." And so he coronated Ashwatthama as the king of his army of three. And meanwhile, the Pandavas were celebrating, and they had all The five Pandavas themselves decided to just stay there on the battlefield for the night. Their remaining troops and families went back to their tents. And so Ashwatthama and his two allies snuck into the camp. He had a certain benediction by which he was able to do that. And then when he went in, he saw the five Pandavas were not there, but their five sons were there. Each of the Pandavas had a son by Draupadi. And these five sons, one of whom was named Shrutikirti, were all very young, but they did take part in the battle. But they were all sound asleep. And not finding their fathers, Ashwatthama went ahead and decapitated each of them in their sleep. And then he took all five heads and went back to Duryodhana and said, "I have killed the Pandavas." So Duryodhana at this point was on the verge of death, but he felt the heads, and then he could understand these are not the Pandavas, these are their sons. So he cursed Ashwatthama. He was so angry. He was not at all pleased. So at this point, this part of the pastime begins. So as we've been reading, Draupadi hears about the death of her sons. Arjuna pledges to avenge her and catch Ashwatthama. And so he and Krishna ride off for this purpose. And then Ashwatthama throws the Brahmastra. So again, he was trained by his father in these subtle mantra-driven weapons, but he did not know how to retract them. He only knew how to throw the nuclear bomb, not bring it back. So Krishna told Arjuna how to counteract it. They captured him, as we discussed yesterday. So this is all of the background. Let's read, though, these verses in which Krishna and Arjuna are having their conversation just prior to their attack on Ashwatthama. So verse 23, could we start maybe on the lady's side? Just read the translations and purports, please. Starting with verse 23.
Text 23. You are the original personality of Godhead who expands himself all over the creation and is transcendental to material energy. You have cast away the effects of the material energy by dint of your spiritual potency. You are always situated in eternal bliss and transcendental knowledge.
Purport. The Lord states in the Bhagavad Gita that one who surrenders unto the lotus feet of the Lord can get released from the clutches of nescience. Krishna is just like the sun, and Maya or material existence is like darkness. Wherever there is light of the sun, darkness or ignorance at once vanishes. The best means to get out of this world of ignorance is suggested here. The Lord is addressed herein as the original personality of Godhead. From him, all other personalities of Godhead expand. The all-pervasive Lord Vishnu is Lord Krishna's plenary portion or expansion. Lord expands himself in innumerable forms of Godhead and living beings along with his different energies. But Sri Krishna is the original primeval Lord from whom everything emanates. The all-pervasive feature of the Lord experienced within the manifested world is also a partial representation of the Lord. Paramatma, therefore, is included within him. He is the absolute personality of Godhead. He has nothing to do with the actions and reactions of the material manifestation because he is far above the material creation. Darkness is a perverse representation of the sun, and therefore existence of darkness depends on the existence of the sun. But in the sun proper, there is no trace of darkness. As the sun is full of light only, similarly, the absolute personality of Godhead is beyond the material existence, full of bliss. He is not only full of bliss, but also full of transcendental variegatedness. Transcendence is not at all static, but full of dynamic variegatedness. He is distinct from the material nature, which is complicated by the three modes of material nature. He is Parama, or the chief. Therefore, he is absolute. He has manifold energies, and through his diverse energies, he creates, manifests, maintains, and destroys the material world. In his own abode, however, everything is eternal and absolute. The world is not conducted by the energies or the powerful agents by themselves, but by the potent, all-powerful, with all energies.
And again, who is speaking here? Arjuna. Arjuna is addressing Krishna.
And yet, Though you are beyond the purview of the material energy, you execute the four principles of liberation characterized by religion, and so on for the ultimate good of the conditioned souls.
The personality of Godhead Sri Krishna, out of his causeless mercy, descends on the manifested world without being influenced by the material modes of nature. He is eternally beyond the material manifestations. He descends out of his causeless mercy only to reclaim the fallen souls who are captivated by the illusory energy. They are attacked by the material energy and they want to enjoy her under false pretext, although in essence the living entity is unable to enjoy. One is eternally the servitor of the Lord, and when he forgets this position, he thinks of enjoying the material world, but factually he is in illusion. The Lord descends to eradicate this false sense of enjoyment and thus reclaim conditioned souls back to Godhead. That is the all-merciful nature of the Lord for the fallen souls.
Thus you descend as an incarnation to remove the burden of the world and to benefit your friends, especially those who are your exclusive devotees and are wrapped in meditation upon you.
It appears that the Lord is partial to his devotees. Everyone is related with the Lord. He is equal to everyone, and yet he is more inclined to his own men and devotees. The Lord is everyone's father. No one can be his father, and yet no one can be his son. His devotees are his kinsmen, and his devotees are his relations. This is his transcendental pastime. It has nothing to do with mundane ideas of relations, fatherhood, or anything like that. As mentioned above, the Lord is above the modes of material nature, and thus there is nothing mundane about his kinsmen and relations in devotional service.
And then 26. See translation in purple.
Yeah. O Lord of Lord, how is it that this dangerous effulgence is spreading all around? Where does it come from? I do not understand it.
Anything that is presented before the personality of Godhead should be so done after due presentation of respectful prayers. That is the standard procedure. And Sri Arjuna, although an intimate friend of the Lord, is observing this method for general information.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. So, think for a moment about the Bhagavad Gita. Where do we find Krishna and Arjuna at the beginning of Bhagavad Gita? On a chariot, right before the battle. Okay, and now 18 days later, where do we find Krishna and Arjuna? In the chariot, having further conversation. Now, what is the difference between the conversation they had prior to the battle and the conversation they're having now? What are some differences? Clayton? So in terms of their relationship, yes. Now Arjuna begins his presentation or his request of Krishna or his question to Krishna by saying, first of all, okay, now I understand that you are in this material world, but you are not affected by it in any way, and that you come and you execute all these duties for the benefit of those of us who are here in this world and not for any other purpose. You're not bound to them. And by the way, what is this glaring effulgence which is about to destroy us? You know, it's a very philosophical. But his consciousness is fully on Krishna. Okay, what else is it? How else could you characterize Arjuna's demeanor at this time compared to the Bhagavad Gita? Yes. Yeah. Where does he begin in the Gita? Senayora Rubayora Madhye, he's giving orders. He said, Krishna, take my chariot between the armies. Over there, over there. Yes, it does. It's the denouement, right? The conclusion ties up the loose strings of the Mahabharata. Right. So, So Arjuna has a very different attitude now. It is completely respectful. It is prayerful. It is realized. He's enlightened. He knows that Krishna is God. He knows that Krishna is his friend. Tony, you can sit over here if you like. Yes, sir. You help me if I need. Okay. His attitude is also very fixed, right? Whereas in the first chapter, how is his consciousness? Yes, right. First he's enthusiastic, then he wants to quit. You know, he's just all over the place, the first and second chapters. So, finally he becomes Krishna's student. But still he has many questions. So at this point he has no questions. So just, it's very interesting, isn't it, how we pick up Krishna and Arjuna again at the beginning of the pastime. These are really the beginning of the pastimes in Srimad Bhagavatam. Here is the conversation between these two. Arjuna has a very immediate pressing concern, but he takes the time to put it in perspective by acknowledging Krishna's supremacy, by recognizing that he's the supreme controller, all-powerful, the whole creation only exists because of him. He reminds himself, he reminds us of these things before proceeding. So it's not that the whole episode of the Bhagavad Gita stops, but it continues in Srimad Bhagavatam, but in a higher level. So this is why the Bhagavatam is called the postgraduate study of Bhagavad Gita. It's understood that the basics are already internalized, and then the rest of the Bhagavatam can make sense to the student. Now, in this regard, how do we approach Krishna? In terms of the modes of nature, how would you characterize the difference between Arjuna's approach at the beginning of this portion of Bhagavatam to the beginning of Gita? Okay, Clayton? Yes, this is the mode of goodness, that one doesn't hit the panic button, you know. Somebody who has expanded consciousness is aware that God is controlling everything. So there's not just a tendency to freak out, which is the mode of passion, or to blame God, which is the mode of ignorance. Clay? Okay. Yeah. So neither mode is influencing him. He is in the mode of goodness, and then, as Clayton correctly pointed out, the mode of pure goodness, or Shuddha Sattva, which is the mode of goodness imbued with enlightened devotional service. So the mode of goodness is a gateway to devotional service. It's not that you can walk around it and go from the mode of passion right to devotional service. We have to go through the mode of goodness. And much of the experience that we get in living in Krishna house, or living in an ashram, is to just bring us to the mode of goodness. Now, it's not everything, but it is definitely part of the boot camp. And it's not the whole experience of Krishna consciousness by any means. Krishna consciousness doesn't stop with the mode of goodness. But it's essential to come to the mode of goodness before one can move on. This is described in the second chapter. Do anyone remember this verse? Tada rajas tamoa bhava kama lobhada yaste. When the influence of passion and ignorance is removed through the practice of devotional service, then kama, lust, and hankering and greed, all these concomitant reactions of the modes are swept out of the way. And then one becomes fixed in goodness and one becomes happy. See, that's the amazing thing about Krishna consciousness, you know, that coming to the mode of goodness makes you happy. That's the characteristic of the mode of goodness. When people are looking through for happiness in the mode of passion and the mode of ignorance and constantly getting frustrated, you know, passion, acquiring, ignorance and forgetting, you know, just any way possible to try to find some happiness. And they're missing it everywhere because it really only comes in the mode of goodness. And so when we're austere, when we're clean, when we're regulated, when we're respectful of other people, when we are proceeding on a constructive course in our lives, these things make us happy. They make us happy in a much deeper way than any external happiness can possibly provide. And that's the remarkable experience of living in an ashram for a time. Yeah.
Person, even though in the mode of ignorance, when they surrender like that, like, I don't know what to do anymore with this material world, then they're eligible for the reception of transcendental knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But in the mode of passion, that doesn't happen at all because the person's constantly calculating materially,
mm-hmm.
and they're wondering, how can I do this, and how can I make this better, and what's the best thing for me to do?
It's an interesting point. You remember the Chatur Vidha Bhajanti Mam, the four types of pious men who surrender to Krishna?
Yeah, there was those who are distressed, those who are in search of money,
mm-hmm.
the naturally curious, and those who are truly seeking.
Yes, so two in the mode of ignorance,
yeah.
and two in the mode of goodness. Those who are seeking money, that is not quite the same.
Those who are in need of money.
Yeah,
yeah.
They are distressed over money. So, yes. But even those in the mode of ignorance, they may be eligible and receptive, but they also have to become purified.
But I mean,
of course they do.
But
yeah.
there's still, I mean, there's the causeless mercy of the Lord that can reveal to them
yes.
some transcendental knowledge, and then receiving that, I mean, they will gradually become purified.
Yes, Patita Pava, Krishna is the friend of the very fallen, Dinabandhu. These names refer to him in that regard, that the most fallen can become elevated. But that section in chapter 2 of the first canto talks about how the candidate, through the regulated process of devotional service, through hearing Bhagavatam and serving the devotees, that person becomes elevated to the mode of goodness, even in spite of themselves, practically. Andrea, you had a point? We have a mic. Okay.
Another difference, I was listening to a Prabhupada lecture and he mentions how Arjuna is so attached,
mm-hmm.
and he says that there's no detachment without knowledge. So after receiving all his knowledge, he became detached of all the family ties that he had, about like all the worries and all the troubles that he had in his head. So now he's like totally surrendered and detached from everything, which he can like engage himself more in Krishna service that way.
Yes, at the same time, he makes this promise to his wife, I'm going to bring you the head of Ashwatthama, and you can stand on it while you're taking your bath. Doesn't sound too detached, you know? But that is his duty, and Krishna is encouraging him. So, before he was all worried about what will become of my family, what will become of the families of all these warriors, now he is... realize I'm doing this all for Krishna. Okay. Gopal?
Speaking about Krishna being in control of everything, I saw on the news last night about a murder. I think it was here in Gainesville, it was on the local news. And there was this old black man who was a relative, and instead of, you know, being all upset and everything, he was saying, "Oh, I know the hand of God is in here somewhere."
Hmm.
And I thought that was like really profound.
They know the hand of God is in there. Yes, the sincere people know the hand of God is in there, but they can't figure out why in the world he's doing it. So I'm actually going to talk about that in a minute. We'll talk about proceeding towards Krishna in the mode of goodness without becoming affected by the modes of nature. Jayashree Krishna and I went to visit a friend named Guru Gauranga Prabhu, and he does seminars for businessmen in which he explains Krishna consciousness without Krishna, essentially. Because as soon as you say Krishna, then most of them turn off the volume. So he was explaining the process of yoga is developing our consciousness. Consciousness means to just be aware of what's around you, right? Like in you know, you think in Bhagavatam class, sometimes there's cognizance and sometimes there's not. Sometimes it's very difficult to stay awake and it's hard to follow the flow of the lecture or whatever. Other times we might be very attentive and interested. So that's just a degree of consciousness that we're manifesting. So Prabhupada calls Krishna consciousness super consciousness, where one is totally aware of everything. This is in the mode of goodness also, to be very conscious of all that is going on around you, not in your head thinking about the past or the future. You know, just totally fixed in the present. So he said there are certain things you can do to enhance your consciousness. Eating a nonviolent diet expands your consciousness. You know, staying away from intoxicants expands your consciousness, your awareness. Then he gave a nice analogy of the tightrope. If you're walking on a tightrope, you know, every step is very measured. And as you're making progress, if you get unbalanced on this side, then you have to correct to come back to the center. If you get unbalanced on that side, then you have to correct to come back to the center. That's why they carry those long poles, right? So they can shift their weight just slightly. So developing our chit, our consciousness, is possible in the mode of goodness. If we are contaminated by the mode of passion, then we're always thinking about, what am I going to do in my future? Okay, I'm here today, but this is not where I want to be. So how can I deal with my future? And therefore, we're just thinking about our future and totally, or to some extent, disconnected from the realities around us. That's the problem with the mode of passion. The mode of ignorance, on the other hand, is this victim mentality. Oh, I have been so abused. I have had so many unfortunate things happen to me. I am the most miserable person. I am the most unfortunate person. You know, if only this hadn't happened. If only I had done this and said, if only I didn't marry that jerk, you know. This is the mode of ignorance, you know. It's all these just useless and unproductive thoughts about the past that can't, you know, dwelling on cannot change at all. So being in the mode of goodness allows us to approach Krishna with thoughtfulness, with perspective, with the proper attitude. If we take Krishna consciousness for granted, what mode is that? Yes. Well, actually it could be that. It could be either one, actually. But that's one of the symptoms of being in the lower modes, that we just think, all right, yes, I've got Krishna down. Now Krishna's in my pocket, and I can pull him out whenever I need him. Now let me get on with the real business of life. I was thinking more like the mode of passion. So we're like, okay, I've got sadhana bhakti down. I know what it means to chant my round. I know what it's all about now. I've read the Bhagavad Gita. Okay, now let me go on to other things. See, this is not how Arjuna is approaching Krishna, is it? He's puts everything in perspective. Okay, God exists, like the man in the news story. Okay, he's that much he acknowledged. The hand of God is in there. But what he doesn't know, what he can't know, is why. And of course, the reason is that he's living in Gainesville, you know, instead of Goloka. He and his whole family have made this conscious choice to come to the material world and enjoy, try to enjoy without God. As Prabhupada wrote in that purport we just read, they come to enjoy but find themselves completely unable to do so. So, as we're walking on the tightrope, approaching Krishna in the mode of goodness, it doesn't mean that there are not going to be problems. Krishna may even take the rope, shake it, you know, just to help us focus more on Him. And not that He may do that, He will do that. You can count on it, you know. Especially in Kali Yuga. In Kali Yuga, the problems are just unique. There's a portion of the Mahabharata where Bhima is outside of Yudhishthira's palace, and people start coming up to him with all kinds of strange questions. One man comes and said, "Bhima, the fence on my property is getting up and moving over into my neighbor's property. What's going on?" He said, "I've never heard of that before. Go ask Yudhishthira. I have no idea." Then another man comes and he says, "Bhima, I took a pot of water and I poured it into four vessels, and then I poured the vessels back into the pot and it only filled it up halfway. What's going on?" So, "I don't know. Go ask Yudhishthira." And then another man comes and said, "Bhima, guess what I just saw? I saw an elephant pass through the eye of a needle, but his tail got stuck on the end. What's going on?" And Bhima said, "Ah, what's going on today? I don't know. Go ask Yudhishthira." And finally, one man comes and said, "Bhima, I saw there was a big boulder in the road, and nobody could budge it. But then a sadhu came, and he just shook his scarf at it, and it moved. What's going on?" "Go ask Yudhishthira." So Yudhishthira then explained, all of these are symptoms of Kali Yuga. The fence is encroaching on the neighbor's property because in Kali Yuga, everybody is envious and wants what the other person has. You know, we mentioned that example of serving prasadam. You know, when something's running out, everybody's looking, how much did they get? The plate is full of prasadam right in front, but I'm only thinking, what did that person? He got more than me. Then the fellow with the water. So this is compared to the relationships we build in Kali Yuga. You pour everything out into the relationship with the family, with the loved ones, with the friends. You pour everything. But that what they give back to you is only half of what you gave them. So they're always disappointing. And then the elephant. The elephant is all about rich people. Rich people can spend money with no limit on anything. But if you ask them for a donation for Krishna, "Oh, my tail has gotten stuck. I have no money. I cannot give for that." They can spend limitless amount, enough for like an elephant amount through the eye of a needle. But if you ask for, "Could you give a little for Krishna?" "Oh, I'm sorry. I can't do that." So these are some of the obstacles in Kali Yuga. Like a big boulder in the road, nobody can move them. But if a saintly person comes in our lives and just shakes a thread at all these obstacles, then they move very quickly. So this is the condition in Kali Yuga. So living in Krishna consciousness is very easy in an ashram setting where we're all helping each other just by our presence come to the mode of goodness. Now, to graduate from the ashram is inevitable for almost everybody. And then when we graduate, then we're into the material world where everything's passion and ignorance. So how do we stay in the mode of goodness so that we're able to remember Krishna and keep perspective when some disaster is about to crack our heads? See, this is the prayer of Kunti that Andrea was so frightened of. Ha, 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 ha. No, I thought that was nice. That was very honest. I never saw that reaction before. Well, and not just you. We're all afraid. Are we really ready to get on our hands, on our knees, and say, God, please bring miseries into my life. Please, I beg you. No. Oh, wait. Yes, are we all right? Okay, enough. Thank you. Yeah. Let me become, yeah, so this is a highly elevated stage. But the rest of the prayer is, because when I have problems, then I see you. So this is the point of the problems. You know, it makes us, how many times that day did the man talk about the hand of God? Probably didn't think too much about it until this tragedy happened. So now he's taking shelter. Okay, it's the hand of God, which is wonderful to have that perspective. But what about the rest of the day? See, we don't, if we're in the mode of goodness, if we're approaching Krishna properly, we don't wait for a disaster. See, like Prabhupada, I'd like to give the example of President Nixon when they sent up Apollo 13. So the spaceship had a problem, as you know from the movie, and Nixon went on the air and asked everyone to pray to God. So when Prabhupada heard this, he chuckled and he said, they did not consult God before shooting up the rocket ship. So approaching Krishna means starting every day according to your capacity to in Krishna consciousness. It's, you can't really replace the morning later in the day. You can't go back and say, okay, I didn't do any Krishna conscious things this morning. I'll squeeze it in during my lunch hour. Before I get to bed, I'll do something Krishna conscious. You know, it doesn't have the same inoculating effect. So that first part of the morning is when our consciousness is at its peak, really, for the day. Naturally, because we just rested. You may not feel like that when you first get up from bed. But by the time you've done your oblations and prepared yourself, then the mind is the most sharp of the entirety. That's the time to think of Krishna. And if you live like that, that's the way to approach Krishna every day. It's when we start thinking, okay, I don't need to worry about that, I'll do it later. That's when we are no longer in the mode of goodness. And approaching Krishna becomes very difficult business. So like I mentioned, the devotees who I'm inviting here to give classes are people I feel who have walked a long way on the tightrope. They managed to live their lives in the mode of goodness and beyond, and remember Krishna through all kinds of circumstances. So it's not that the problems of Kali Yuga won't come, but when they come, instead of just hitting the panic button, like Arjuna, we remember, okay, Krishna, you're in control. You're transcendental. Now, please tell me about this disaster. Okay, any questions or comments?
In this whole epic of the Mahabharat, I don't know how to phrase the question, but I'm just always wondering why this kind of scenario, what are we to learn from this? I mean, you know, if we think about God, it's almost more easy to think of him in Goloka Vrindavan, just enjoying. But it's almost more like God's activities. What are we to learn from all these intricate things that happened in the Mahabharata, and Krishna's involved in it? And
why doesn't he just invoke the God card and say, "Okay, I'm just making it like this"?
Yes.
Do it, yeah. Because it is a chance to for his devotees to be glorified. That's one thing. It is also his pleasure. Everything God does is for his pleasure. So he takes pleasure also. It's a great variety. All the things that a person might enjoy in life, God is also, he is the original enjoyer of those things. So people like politics. They like intrigue. They like drama. They like adventure and chivalry. And so Krishna does all these things also. He also enjoys them. Because he enjoys them, we also enjoy them. So he exercises all of these activities. The Mahabharata is full of that. Sometimes his will is apparently thwarted. But what was his purpose, as we read in the very beginning of the 10th canto? What was his whole purpose in coming to the earth? To remove the burden of the earth. Remember, Bhumi was so distressed because all of these armies were built up. And so she came to the gods, and the gods went to Krishna and said, Lord Vishnu, rather. And he said, don't worry, Krishna is coming. So that was Krishna's purpose, to remove the burden of the earth. And so he engineered the whole thing through this battle in which so many millions and millions of men were killed in just a few days. You see? So it's always for his purpose.
Are these pastimes... Because I've heard some lectures where they say that Krishna's pastimes are reenacted over and over again in different places. Is this pastime also like reenacted?
Yes, his pastimes are eternal. They're ever fresh. Just like Radharani never cooks the same preparation twice. So Krishna's pastimes always have different flavors and nuances. And that's why we read sometimes about various appearances of Lord Maraha, for example. The pastime's slightly different. The color is slightly different. Okay. Other comments or questions? Andrea? Go ahead.
About devotional service, like what if you're not feeling like doing devotional service because you're like, I don't feel like doing it, I'm tired, why should I do it, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are there any consequences of feeling that way or thinking that?
It's just part of our purification. See, mode of passion makes us think we're the best devotee in the temple. And many of us experience this. Oh, okay, I understand Krishna consciousness. I'm going to do this all the way. And we think we're more advanced than we are. So what's the problem, man? You know. and then things like this start coming out. After a while, the rush of getting admiration and distinction begins to fade. And then we find that in our hearts, it's not all that exciting for me. You know, so that just means that's... and the fact that we're aware of it is also part of our purification. We're beginning to see, I'm really not so... I'm not on the spontaneous platform. You know, I'm not an Uttama Adhikari after all. You know, I am... In fact, in my heart, I find practically no interest in serving Krishna. See, this is a very... it can be a very shocking realization. And then we can also get in the mode of ignorance and feel, it's impossible. So... to be persistent, see, it's the mode of goodness. Whether we feel like it or don't feel like it, we do it. And we do it not because we're getting praise or getting recognition or getting some benefit, but we do it because we want to please Krishna. So this is the gradual process of coming to the mode of goodness. And from that position, we can offer Krishna sincerely, very simply, I just want to serve you. That's all.
Like every day we're chanting, you know, like, Krishna, please engage me in your service. And then, like, we're so ungrateful and then, like, turn the service down. Like, will he take it away from us if we keep doing that, like, at some point?
At some point, if we really don't want to do it. But, you see, the mode of goodness is sustainable. I love that word. This is a popular buzzword. But it's also, it just really embodies the mode of goodness. It's sustainable. So if we can do 10 gallons of devotional service, but we're trying to do 20, but our actual tank only holds 10, then we don't impress Krishna by doing so much beyond, because we can't sustain it. Yes. In fact, it's a cause of fall down. So to strike the balance where we can sustain a steady output of devotional service, a steady practice of sadhana, this is the art of staying in Krishna consciousness your whole life. That's what it takes, always to find that realistic balance. And it's not the same for every person, and it's not the same for every situation. So, to it's important that we prevent our minds from being judgmental of others, saying they're not executing Krishna consciousness like I am, therefore they don't really understand it. See? Just people will take care of themselves. Are we doing the best we can under our given circumstances? Yes. Olivia, you want to add to that? Or comment? Go ahead. All the men are very quiet. I guess the men already know all of this stuff. Just the ladies here. Oh, should you start? Okay. Go ahead, Olivia. We'll squeeze it in.
I just have a comment to make about what Andrea was talking about, because I've been thinking about that too, and it's so complex, it's hard to describe, but I feel like the desire to please Krishna, I go in extremes. Like one day the pendulum's all the way over here, and I'm like, oh, what would be good for Krishna? And the other day it's like, I can't really perceive this relationship like with my material senses, my relationship with Krishna. I can't necessarily, the reciprocation, it's not like you go to work and you get the paycheck, you know? So it's hard. I found for myself, sometimes it's harder for me to think in the mindset of like, oh, I should just do this to please Krishna. But I realize it's easier for me where I am right now, like at the stage that I am, it's easier for me to think, will this please the devotees? Like, is this pleasing to the devotees? And in that way to get, you know, motivated to do the spontaneous service.
That's very nice. So in other words, the relationship with Krishna is intangible, but the relationship with the devotees is very tangible.
Yeah, just like for me where I am,
That's true for us all. And Krishna says that one who claims to be my devotee is not my devotee, but one who is the devotee of my devotee is actually my devotee. Rupa Goswami gives a beautiful definition of love. Would you like to hear that? A loving relationship is one in which you continue in spite of there being every reason not to do it. That is a loving relationship. Is that right? Yeah. You carry on that relationship even though every reason tells you shouldn't be doing it. There's no good reason. So Krishna consciousness is like that. There definitely be times when you think, what's the point? And then it's just a matter of determination. No, I'm convinced by my intelligence, serving Krishna is the purpose of life. Let me carry on, even though it hurts, or even though it doesn't feel...